Hi, and welcome to A Palace for the People. I am Onjiro Koinange.
And I am Angela Washuka.
This is a podcast about what Kenya's past can tell us about Kenya's present.
You might already know that.
Unless, of course, you picked this episode to listen to randomly. So I'm going to say it again for the benefit of our new listeners. Each episode, we take something we have found in the archive of the Macmillan Memorial Library, and we use it to tell a story about our country, about our history. And today's item is pretty incredible. So we're looking at, let's call it a scrapbook. It's a scrapbook. It's one of three that we have at the library, and the front cover looks like, you know how like ransom notes are written,
right?
With cut out pieces of magazines. So this person, whoever it was that made this scrapbook, they have cut out letters for the dates January 16th and February 25th, which I guess is the time period that this particular scrapbook covers. It's scrapbook number 8, 1954. We do not have 1-7, nor do we know if they exist. But what we have is the title of this scrapbook, which is Mau Mau Day-to-Day Record, January 16th to February 25th, 1954.
And when you open it up, or if you flip through it, you just see article after article of stories about Mau Mau. The title really is true. This is a day-to-day record of just over a month during 1954. There's an article,
or more than one,
from every single day during this period. Success for Home Guards, that notorious group.
European wounded by Nairobi thieves.
Police seize £500 hidden in shop.
Renewed call to surrender. Leaflet flight over reserve today.
Guard posts attacked by gangs.
26 thugs killed at the weekend.
Daylight raid on building site.
Hardcore terrorist killed. 3 more terrorist officers die in clashes.
Gangs on the run, harried by bombers. I think it says here 197 Mau Mau killed in 9 days. And it calls it biggest success yet.
Biggest success yet. Oof.
East African Standard. All these are from English language papers at the time.
You mean British run papers?
That's evident from the way the Mau Mau was spoken about as terrorists, of course.
You can feel the fear. It's such an immediate piece of history. Like, you're seeing these things happen in real time.
This is so cool because it's like a historian's dream. Because we usually have to spend like hours and hours and hours trying to like looking through every newspaper for every day to find the one article about Mau Mau, and they've just put it all in one document.
This is Rose Mionga.
I am currently working on a PhD, yet to be titled, but focusing on memories of Mau Mau in post-independence Kenya. So I'm really interested in the way that the Mau Mau War has been historicized and its role in national history as well as in communal history and individual people's lives. You know, Mau Mau was not in the national curriculum, or, you know, it was a small side note, and, you know, there wasn't public discourse on it. My stepfather's Kikuyu, and we spent a lot of time in Nyeri. As a child growing up in Kenya, Mau Mau was in my general awareness, but never as sort of a point of academic study within school. It was more kind of a note in family history.
I think that's a fairly common story. It is in my family, at least.
Oh, yeah. Mine too. I have some memories of my maternal grandmother mentioning some things that I now wish, of course, I'd taken the time to speak to her about some more. And this information will get out in bits and bobs. But I also got the sense that it was a very, very painful thing to talk about. And she'd say things like, we used to go into the forest to provide food, but we never really got past that. It wouldn't sort of mature into like, okay, let me tell you the story of 1954 and what exactly happened. So it's a bit of a mystery.
Yep, same. Like, no specifics. If I ask about the emergency, for instance, it will be described as a reason why, for instance, my father didn't grow up with his mom. Between 1952 and 58, my grandmother was in exile, so my dad only really met his mom much later. So when you ask about the strange relationship, you're just like, oh, it's because she wasn't around, because she wasn't around, but you never really kind of speak about why. You're just kind of supposed to pick through all of these bits and bobs, as you call them.
Yeah.
And of course, when you're young, you're not really interested in your parents' lives. you just kind of, they only exist as your parents until you get older and you realize you haven't talked about it for so long and now it's hard. It's way too hard.
And painful.
But also frustrating, because are you like, is it too painful or are we just too polite? Are we too reticent about the thing? Is it painful because of what happened then or what happened or didn't happen later?
Mm. And like every episode, for this really fascinating story, we have to go back in time.
Good evening. Today is the 21st of October, 1952. Leading African nationalist Jomo Kenyatta has been arrested following the declaration of a state of emergency in the British colony of Kenya. The Mau Mau is demanding immediate self-government and is blamed for the mounting lawlessness, violence, and disorder in the colony. Jomo Kenyatta stands accused of leading the extremist wing of the Mau Mau and of inciting hatred and violence against Europeans through a series of oaths of allegiance. Now back to you over at Bookbunk.
So in 1952, Jomo Kenyatta was first arrested. He was sentenced to imprisonment and was essentially exiled in northern Kenya because of his supposed involvement in the Mau Mau. However, what we now know is that Kenyatta wasn't a leader of the Mau Mau movement. He was definitely a political agitator. He was a Pan-Africanist. He'd been in London for many years and sort of developed a relationship with George Padmore and with other Pan-Africanist organizers. He was the president of the KAU, which was the Kenya African Union, which was a nationalist party that was pushing for independence and for more rights for Africans within Kenya. However, he was not a Mau Mau leader.
And do you condemn Mau Mau violence and oath-taking?
Well, I have never approved of any violence at all. My leadership has not been to darkness and death, but to light and prosperity.
There were some people who were involved in the KAU who supported the Mau Mau movement, but Kenyatta was explicitly against a violent uprising and was much more interested in constitutional political campaigning for independence. However, because of the emergency rules, the British kind of took the opportunity to take out as many political agitators as possible under the Mau Mau state of emergency laws.
One of the things Mau Mau was renowned for was for the culture of secrecy and swearing oaths not to reveal things.
That is right, because the war was fought in a way where people only knew what was happening in their unit, so they didn't always have all the information.
Yeah, this was crucial to their survival as an organization, but it also left gaps in people's knowledge, and these gaps could be filled with all manner of falsehoods and myths. One popular myth, for example, was that Kenyatta was their leader. And then, in a way, because Kenyatta had been scapegoated by the British, his imprisonment kind of added to his reputation.
So he wasn't an active Mau Mau member, although, of course, he had communications with people within the KAU. And because of his international connections, he, in some ways, became the face of Kenya's campaign for independence, so much so that sort of in the early 1960s, as Kenya's kind of coming towards its independence, the slogan is Uhuru na Kenyatta. It's literally independence with Kenyatta. So the campaign for Kenyatta's release becomes very tied up with the campaign for independence. And in the messy processes of early post-independence history making, that also becomes tied up with the history of the Mau Mau. What's really interesting to me is sort of how powerful Kenyatta's myth has become. So what was essentially a British conspiracy really penetrated so deeply into kind of popular understandings of Mau Mau that when I now talk to Mau Mau survivors, many of them say, oh yeah, Kenyatta was our leader, which is actually not factual. But it's really interesting the way that that myth was first created by the British and then kind of perpetuated by Kenyatta after independence. He maintained a somewhat ambiguous position towards Mau Mau, not really wanting to fully accept and claim them, which probably would have meant sort of accepting and taking seriously their claims for land and their sort of radical redistributive politics.
And we cannot talk about the Mau Mau, about independence, without talking about land. Their slogan, Idha Kanawe Yadhi, can be translated as freedom through land. But let's start with a different slogan about land, one I think we have all heard before.
I know what you're going to say. Willing seller, willing buyer, right?
As Britain is sort of preparing for exit from empire, one of the key concerns of the independence negotiations is land. And from the British perspective, their priority is that all the white British citizens, essentially, who had come to Kenya when it was kind of being promoted as a settler colony and settled in Kenya, that should they wish to now leave in the time of independence, that they should receive just compensation, or what the British perceived to be just compensation for their land. So in the early 1960s, after a lot of negotiation, a land purchase scheme is devised, which basically means that European settlers who want to leave are able to sell their land for a premium to the Kenyan government, the newly independent Kenyan government, which takes out loans from the British, which will have to be paid back in order to buy this land.
That is ridiculous. No way that math is mathing.
Right?
And then the land that's been purchased from European settlers is then available for native Kenyans to resettle. However, this resettlement is at a cost. So land is to be purchased either using a loan, or if you have money, you can buy the land. And the scheme is called the Million Acre Scheme. And it's also very connected to this idea of sort of development and agriculture. So people who apply to get land under the scheme are prioritised if they have experience with modern agricultural techniques. If we think back to Mau Mau, obviously the Mau Mau people who've been either imprisoned in detention camps or fighting in the forests probably haven't been learning new agricultural techniques. So they're disadvantaged in that. And also they haven't been earning money or developing credit in order that they're able to buy back the land that they might believe is their sort of homeland. Elite post-independence Kenyan government members end up retaining large patches of land for themselves. There was no radical redistributive politics after independence. And the issues of landlessness and land poverty and land alienation and the sort of bitterness and resentment actually continued to this day.
After all that struggle for land and freedom, Mau Mau maybe got their freedom, but definitely not land.
Because of course, freedom only came with land. Their slogan was freedom through land. Mm-hmm. So if they never got their land, did they get their freedom?
Over 1 million people were involved in this conflict in some way or another, and it really penetrated everyday life. So this wasn't a conflict that was focused on big battles on battlefields. This was happening in people's homes, in people's villages, and it had a really deep and lasting effect on people's everyday lives, on their families, on their marriages and their children. Because of the way that the British counterinsurgency was conducted, it really tore people's lives apart. You know, people were forced to move from their homes. Spouses were separated, often for up to 7 years. In that time, sometimes people had new relationships, and so families took on different forms. For women especially, there was, and for men too, there was a lot of sexual violence that had lasting impacts on their fertility and their ability to sort of continue building families. Those are kind of the visible sites where you can kind of see the contours of these histories living out into the future. And then there's just, there are sort of invisible sites as well, where it's just within people's memories. You know, in Kenya, there wasn't something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission like they had in South Africa. And Kenyatta's slogan, as he said in a speech just after independence, was forgive and forget. We need to let go of the past and move on.
If I have done mistake to you, it's for you to forgive me. If you have done to me, I say, it's for me to forgive you.
His other sort of mantra was, we all fought for Uhuru. So, you know, the Mau Mau were just one of the ways, which, you know, there is some historical truth to the fact that the Mau Mau were not the only nationalist movement who was fighting for independence, but they were certainly one of the most important ones and the ones who suffered most deeply for that campaign.
We are not going to look backward. We are going to forgive the past.
And in the years after independence, it became dangerous to talk in certain ways about Mau Mau.
You know, there were a lot of autobiographies written. There were some works of fiction, you know, Ngugi wa Thiong'o is probably the most famous. But a lot of those authors ended up political prisoners under Kenyatta or under Moi. So from the 80s, it was actually quite dangerous to be talking publicly about Mau Mau. It wasn't something that people would do lightly, and it was a real legitimate fear. You know, it wasn't like an imagined fear. You might end up in prison if you're talking about Mau Mau.
I think that's a really important point. Remember when we began this and you were asking me, or I was asking you, I can't remember, but we were talking about the Mau Mau and I asked you what you knew. And we were saying and feeling this frustration about the lack of information, mm-hmm. And the lack of talking about them.
Yep.
But before 2004, when Kenya's third president, Mwai Kibaki, declared that Mau Mau were not a terrorist group, many people risked it all to talk about the Mau Mau.
And they were silenced, as we know, in different ways.
Which ultimately leads us to this uneasy status quo. We remember the Mau Mau, but we don't learn about them at school. We have all of these incomplete pieces. Mm. And meanwhile, the actual Mau Mau are still fighting for the same thing, for freedom through land.
As I hope I've explained, it's a very complex issue. And I sadly don't think there's a sort of magic wand solution, although I wish there were. When I think about restorative justice, I don't know that there's ever a possibility of sort of returning or restoring a sort of utopian pre-colonial past that may or may not have existed to begin with. But I do think like maybe like transformative justice is possible. I think about the potential for sort of a radical redistribution of resources, and I'm sad that there doesn't seem to be the political will in this country, or really in any country for that. What I would say also is that this feels very urgent and emergent because it's a generation of people who are about to die out. Like a lot of Mau Mau have already died. And the survivors are in their late 80s and 90s. So this is something that requires our attention now if it's to happen while these people are still alive.
Yep, this work is urgent. And we have this scrapbook, and you know, we still don't really know who made it.
No, we don't. So who cut out those letters, which are in themselves very serial killer-esque? And whether it was made at the time or it was made later on, say after independence, it's an interesting question.
Oh, I love the historical mystery. This is absolutely a guess, but I would imagine it's more likely that it was made contemporarily, just because it almost seems like someone's project that they would do daily. If you're reading the newspaper every day and cutting it and putting it in, that seems like much less of a mammoth task than doing it after the event and going through every single newspaper from the time, which it would just require much more energy and dedication. And then I'd wonder more about the motivation of it in post-independence Kenya by a Kenyan librarian when it's mainly propaganda, anti-Mama propaganda.
But the scrapbook is just one record. Well, three. We have three scrapbooks, actually, which is great, but they are incomplete.
As an oral historian, I do have a bit of a bee in my bonnet about the fact that often if you use oral histories, you have to back them up with written histories. But historians are rarely expected to back up their written evidence with oral evidence. And I think oral histories also make you think much more expansively about what happened in the past.
We agree, which is why our project called The Missing Bits exists.
Indeed. So The Missing Bits seeks to actively plug the gaps that we're finding in the library's archive. Basically, we crowdsource public memories and people bring in their versions, say of this scrapbook, for example, or letters and photos and other memories they may have, so we can capture them and add them to the library's archive.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And we actually have an active call now. So please go check out our website for more information on how you can plug into The Missing Bits.
I'm 63.
I was born in 18th November 1948. It's because he had fought in the Second World War.
We were not allowed not to go to church without headscarf.
So I remember one night, I can't remember exactly when, but one night they wanted to come and finish us.
And I remember where we would go to different places around Nairobi, you know, different hotels and whatnot, and listen to bands that would play reggae or listen to TPOK jazz.
Now there was more freedom, as okay. I said. Mm-hmm. There were no rules as mm-hmm. to how one dressed.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. As you grow up, you realize, that's not me.
No.
This is A Palace for the People. I am Wanjiro Koinange.
And I am Angela Washuka. This episode was produced by me, Angela Washuka, Wanjiro Koinange, Maeve Francis, and Ida Holy Nambi. This is a Fathom Sirens production. You can learn more about our work at bookbank.org.
This podcast is supported by the Cultural Protection Fund, a partnership between the British Council and the UK Government's Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport. Thank you for listening.